Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, it's Hannah Gelbart here. I'm the host of the What in the World podcast. Every weekday, we help you make sense of what's happening around the globe. I want to tell you about our special episode on P-pop. That's Filipino pop. Now, you might be more familiar with K-pop, a multi-billion dollar industry. Well, P-pop is hoping to get a share of that global success. So join me to hear from top boy band Alamat about what sets P-pop apart. Just search for What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 12th of April. O.J. Simpson, who was cleared in the trial of the century, has died at the age of 76.
It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
The former American football star had earlier tried to evade arrest in a televised car chase after being accused of the double murder.
Highway Patrol.
I think I just saw O.J. Simpson on the 5 freeway, and he, stared us down like he was dead.
We hear from a journalist who covered the trial. In other news, Ukraine says the biggest power plant in the Kyiv region has been destroyed in a Russian attack. And Instagram trials a new tool to combat so-called sextortion. Also in the podcast, thousands of Afghan children who fled to Iran are now being sent back home alone.
A lot of them haven't got refugee status or official documents, so many of them are arrested and just directly taken to camps and then deported.
And a big night for the global gaming industry. Orenthal James Simpson, who was once the most famous murder suspect in the world, has died at the age of 76. The former American footballer was already a huge celebrity when he was thrust into the global limelight in the so-called trial of the century. He was accused of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend, Ronald Goldman, in 1994. He had already been watched by millions on TV trying to evade police in a low-speed car chase. Thanks to his high-powered legal team, he was acquitted, but later jailed for armed robbery and kidnapping. Ronald Goldman's father has released a statement saying O.J. Simpson's death is no great loss. Our first report is from Tom Bateman in Washington.
O.J. Simpson was an American icon for decades before his stardom became infamy. O.J., or the Juice, electrified sports fans in the late 1960s and 70s, a running back at the University of Southern California, college football's top player. He had a record-setting career in the NFL with the Buffalo Bills and San Francisco 49ers. Simpson turned his football fame into a career as a sports broadcaster, advertising pitchman, and then Hollywood actor in films including the Naked Gun spoof cop series, in which he played a witless police detective alongside the actor Leslie Nielsen.
Who were they?
Ship. Boat.
That's right, Nordberg, a boat. Now, when you're better, we'll go sailing together on a boat. We'll take a cruise just like last year.
All that changed in 1994 after his former wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ronald Goldman were found stabbed to death outside her Los Angeles home. Simpson quickly emerged as a suspect. He was ordered to surrender to police, but 5 days after the killings, he fled in his white Ford Bronco with a former teammate, carrying his passport and a disguise.
911, what are you reporting?
I have O.J. in the car. He's still alive, but he got a gun to his head.
The chase was televised live from a news helicopter, viewed by an estimated 95 million people, ultimately culminating in Simpson's surrender to police and murder charges. What ensued was one of the most notorious trials in 20th century America and a media circus. A rich celebrity defendant, a black man accused of killing his white former wife out of jealousy, a woman slain after divorcing a man who'd beaten her, and a dream team of pricey but charismatic defense lawyers. The trial transfixed America and crystallized its racial divisions. Prosecutors argued that Simpson killed Nicole in a jealous fury. The defense countered that the defendant was framed by racist white police. Prosecutors made Simpson try on a pair of bloodstained gloves found at the murder scene. In a highly theatrical demonstration, he struggled to put them on. And delivering the trial's most famous words, defence lawyer Johnny Cochran made his closing arguments.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Simpson was found not guilty. He waved at the jurors and mouthed the words, "Thank you," after the predominantly black panel of 10 women and 2 men acquitted him. The Goldman and Brown families later pursued a wrongful death lawsuit against Simpson in civil court, and a predominantly white jury found him liable for the 2 deaths, ordering him to pay $35 million in damages. And in 2008, exactly 13 years after his acquittal in the murder trial, Simpson was convicted by a Las Vegas jury on charges including kidnapping and armed robbery. He was led away in a prison jumpsuit and leg shackles and protested he didn't want to hurt anybody. Simpson said, "I didn't know I was doing anything wrong."
Tom Bateman reporting. For an assessment of O.J. Simpson's life, I spoke to Tonya Hart from Hollywood Live. She says despite his success as an American footballer and actor, he'll be defined by the double murder trial.
Always. And that's such a shame. It's such a travesty. The whole thing. There are no winners here. It was just one of those things that changed America, but it did give us reality television for the good or bad, because that's how it started here.
The televised trial, it was huge, but also very divisive.
Very much so. 100 million people tuned into the verdict of that trial. It's just amazing. I mean, nothing like that has happened since. It was divisive because Johnny Cochran was my neighbor, by the way, and knew him well. OJ, I had only met socially, you know, over the years. And then after the trial, I covered the trial for E! And was in the courtroom that day. When they pulled that glove on, I got to tell you, I'm looking at it and I'm like, that's not going to fit him. He's not going to be able to get his hand in that because it had shrunk. And of course he couldn't. And that's when Johnny came out with that great line, if the glove does not fit, you must acquit. And they did. Johnny was able to move the trial from Santa Monica to Los Angeles downtown, where he knew he would have a black and brown jury pool. And he knew that because of the disparity here in America between blacks and whites, that he would be able to get that jury on his side. And he absolutely did. And that was really what happened. Of course, the civil trial happened back in Santa Monica, and they did get that $33 million, I guess, judgment against him. However, none of that money was ever paid to the Goldmans or the Browns. And so, like I said, it's just a sad story. You look at his children, who apparently were by his side when he passed away, but their lives have been just really torn apart. What do you say when your father has been accused of killing your mother? How do you get over that? You don't.
And eventually, he did end up in jail in an unrelated crime, an armed robbery in Las Vegas.
Yes. I mean, anytime anybody gets away with a double murder, he was acquitted. He was supposed to be going after the murderer and seeing if he could find out who did it. No one's ever come to trial for that again. Think about that. You know, where is the murderer? It wasn't OJ. I'll just say it like it is. And I think the only reason that he was charged in Las Vegas, which was basically, you know, he would have had a slap on his hand had he not been acquitted for this murder, to be honest. I think in his mind at that particular time, he felt he was above the law. I mean, he just did. And that's what happened. And said, nope, he's going to jail for something. And he did for 9 years.
What's been the reaction to his death where you are in Los Angeles?
Well, it's all over the news. You know, all of the news stations covered it. It's been everywhere all morning. People are dissecting the trial, looking back at the video. It's very interesting. OJ was such a charismatic person and such a great football player that he crossed over. There were no boundaries for him.
Tonya Hart from Hollywood Live on OJ Simpson, who's died at the age of 76. Other news now, and Mexico has filed a lawsuit at the International Court of Justice demanding Ecuador's expulsion from the United Nations over its raid on the Mexican embassy in Quito last Friday. Mexico accuses the Ecuadorian president, Daniel Noboa, of violating diplomatic law. The incident drew condemnation across Latin America. Ecuadorian authorities say they were trying to prevent the escape of Jorge Glass, a former vice president who was seeking asylum in the Mexican embassy, but who was wanted for alleged corruption. Our Mexico correspondent Will Grant has the details.
The ill feeling between Mexico and Ecuador continues to grow. In the latest development, Mexico has called on the United Nations to suspend Ecuador following the police raid on the Mexican embassy in Quito. A Mexican delegation filed its complaint at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, a move which was applauded by the Mexican president Andrés Manuel López Obrador at his daily news conference in Mexico City. In accordance with the United Nations Charter, he said, the UN should approve the expulsion and there should be no veto from the Security Council, he added. Last week, Ecuadorian police entered Mexico's diplomatic mission in Quito to arrest Ecuador's former vice president, Jorge Glass, who had been granted political asylum by Mexico and was inside its embassy. In scenes which have prompted widespread condemnation around the world and across the political spectrum in Mexico, the Mexican chargé d'affaires was thrown to the ground by officers and Mr. Glass was dragged out of the building. The Ecuadorian president, Daniel Noboa, has refused to apologise for the incident, saying Ecuador's people reject any kind of impunity for criminals, corruption or narco-terrorists. Former Vice President Glass was facing embezzlement charges and had been living inside Mexico's embassy since December.
Will Grant in Mexico. The Tropilska power plant in central Ukraine provides electricity for three regions around the capital, Kiev. Or at least it did. It was destroyed in Russia's latest attack on Ukraine's energy facilities overnight, Wednesday into Thursday. The Ukrainians managed to shoot down more than two-thirds of the missiles and drones used in the assault, but 20 got through. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has appealed to Western allies for more air defences. Yuri Sak is an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Strategic Industries.
That power plant, which was the major source of power generation for Kyiv region, Cherkasy region and Zhytomyr region, the total number of people who live there is about 7 million. It was attacked by 20 cruise missiles, 6 hypersonic missiles, and it was attacked by 4 ballistic missiles. There were also launches of Shahed drones. What we are facing right now is a severe energy crisis in central Ukraine. And of course, other parts of Ukraine have also been target of this another terrorist missile attack. So the situation is pretty serious.
Well, Miroslav Yencha is the UN Assistant Secretary General for Europe, Central Asia and the Americas. Speaking in New York, he gave more details about the Russian attacks.
Since March, the large-scale coordinated attacks on critical infrastructure destroyed or damaged more than 24 energy facilities throughout the country, including the Dnipro hydroelectric power plant. These attacks have disrupted access to electricity for millions of Ukrainians in large cities and in rural areas. Water supply was also disrupted in some locations. The disruptions may last for many months due to the extent of the widespread damage.
Well, among the cities affected in this latest attack was the second largest, Kharkiv, where 200,000 people were left without power. The BBC's Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has this update from the city.
It's dark, but perhaps not as dark as you might think. I mean, this is an extraordinary city. It always has been. Kharkiv has a reputation for being unbreakable and indomitable. And so I'm standing now on probably the main square, I guess, right by the city administration. There's a hotel behind me with a massive hole in the side of it. That's a hotel we always used to use, but it's had a missile through the side of it in recent months. But just alongside, there's a restaurant where the lights are on. They work on generators when they don't get mains power. There are people sitting out on the terrace, eating their dinner, having a drink. There are kids around and about on scooters. And yet there are constant air raids and there are missile strikes. And at the moment in Kharkiv, like right across Ukraine, they're targeting the power supply. And it is having a massive effect, not just on the fact that, you know, houses are having rolling blackouts so you can come home and have no power for sort of 6 hours a day. But it's also obviously affecting industrial production. It's affecting every single business that works here. And Kharkiv has basically had all of its power supply. So all the power plants in that supplied the city have been totally destroyed. So they are now relying on power coming from outside of Kharkiv, and Russia is going after that too. So it is, it's worrying, I think I would say.
Sarah Rainsford in Ukraine's second city. The humanitarian organisation Doctors Without Borders is warning that a catastrophic hunger crisis in Sudan is worse than feared. It assessed the health of tens of thousands of children and women in a displaced people's camp in North Darfur state, and found one in three was malnourished. A year of war between the army and a rival paramilitary group has had a devastating humanitarian impact across Sudan, especially in Darfur. Our Africa correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher reports.
At least one child dies every 2 hours in the Zamzam camp for displaced people, according to Doctors Without Borders. It has just completed a mass screening of mothers and children under five and found one-third of them to be acutely malnourished. That's double the threshold for a nutrition emergency. And this is only one camp in one small part of Darfur. A regional emergency worker sent the BBC photos of emaciated children from other areas of the region that are even more cut off. Sudan's conflict has displaced millions of people, ruined the economy, and blocked aid to vulnerable populations. Humanitarian workers say it will not be possible to turn the tide on this catastrophe unless there is a surge of food supplies and much greater access to deliver it.
Barbara Platt-Usher in Nairobi. Governments around the world have warned of the increasing threat to young people from sextortion, a form of blackmail involving the exploitation of intimate online pictures. Now, Instagram has announced the trial of a new tool to try to protect users. It works by blurring naked images sent in direct messages. This nudity protection will be turned on by default for under-18s. Our technology reporter Chris Valance told me about the scale of the problem.
Well, I mean, Instagram calls sextortion a horrific crime. It's quite hard to disagree with that assessment. Essentially, you've got criminals who will pretend to be, let's say, an attractive young woman, and they'll encourage, perhaps by sending a naked picture or to the victim, usually a man or a teenage boy, to exchange naked images of themselves and then blackmail them with the aim of extorting money. It's a terrible crime, and it's an international crime. We recently had two Nigerian men plead guilty to sexually extorting teenage boys and young men in the US, including one who took his own life. The FBI says between 2021 and March 2023, there were 13,000 reports of online financial sextortion of minors, primarily boys, and that led to at least 20 suicides. You can see why governments are concerned.
Yeah, obviously has a dreadful impact. Tell us how this tool will combat the problem and whether it'll work.
Well, essentially, the tool is an AI-powered nudity detector, if you like, that runs entirely on the device. And what it does is it blurs naked images in direct messages when it spots them. But it does more than that. So when somebody tries to send a naked picture that the AI has spotted, essentially what it will do is it will sort of warn them that the image could be screenshot, that it might be shared, that it might be seen by families. So that, it's hoped, would stop someone sending a naked image to a criminal. And then on the other side, when you receive it, it also blurs the image. So you've got the option whether or not to look at the image, but it also says, look, you don't need to feel pressured to respond to the image. Again, a sort of, if you like, a nudge not to necessarily engage with someone who is a criminal.
Our technology reporter, Chris Valance. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
We are very proud of being a part of such an Artemis international program.
Why a Japanese astronaut is set to become the first non-American to set foot on the moon. The scale of sexual abuse in the Roman Catholic Church around the world has taken decades to emerge. Last summer, on a visit to Portugal, Pope Francis acknowledged the pain caused by the failure to tackle the crisis.
It is often accentuated by the disappointment and the anger with which some people view the Church due to our poor witness and the scandals that have marred her face and call us to a humble and ongoing purification, starting with the anguished cry of the victims who must always be accepted and listened to.
Well, now the Church in Portugal has become the latest to try to make amends with the creation of a fund to pay reparations to victims of clerical sexual abuse. It follows an explosive report last year which revealed the systematic cover-up of the abuse of almost 5,000 children. I heard more details from our correspondent in Portugal, Alison Roberts.
The Church, in the wake of that really devastating report, which included some quite graphic details from individual cases, set up another expert group to receive complaints from any victims that hadn't come forward already, and also began to look at this question of possible reparations, which is the word that they use, rather compensation for any victims that might want it. We haven't been given a lot of detail. It does seem that the expert group that they set up had put forward some suggestions for criteria on which amounts could be decided. The bishops then sent that back to the group with some suggested changes. The group then sent it back, and none of this has come out into the public forum. So the group itself has been making some announcements, for example, the fact that 20 victims have expressed the desire for compensation, but we don't know the details of, as I say, of these criteria. So what the bishops say is that between June and December of this year, they will be accepting requests, but that a commission in order to decide any amounts has yet to be set up, and they will be calling on that group of experts and other experts outside of the church to decide who should be on that commission and on what basis they should be making those decisions.
Alison Roberts in Lisbon. Antonio Grosso is the co-founder of a lobby group for abuse survivors called the Silenced Heart Association. He says this latest announcement is disappointing.
The criteria have not yet been defined. The amounts of compensation have not yet been defined. And it says that they will create a fund, but it doesn't say how much will be in this fund to distribute to survivors. And it says they'll passively await requests for compensation. We are not beggars.
Antonio Grosso of the Silenced Heart Association. The capital of Colombia and the surrounding region around Bogotá have started rationing water after a drought made worse by the El Niño weather phenomenon. Reservoirs are critically low, with one that helps provide the capital's water at less than 17% capacity. Here's Mimi Swaby.
Bogotá and 11 municipalities surrounding it are suffering their most severe water scarcity in 40 years. At least 9 million people will be impacted by the drastic rationing measures introduced today. It's hoped household consumption of water will drop by around 11%. The region has been split into 9 different zones, and each one will take turns switching off its water services. The restrictions began at 8 a.m. local time and will last 24 hours before shifting to the next zone in line. Hospitals and schools are not included. They have separate contingency plans. Bogotá's mayor said the measures will be in place until water levels improve, but restrictions will be reviewed in a fortnight.
Mimi Swaby. Afghanistan says Iran has deported 20,000 Afghan children who'd entered the country illegally during the last year. The children say many of their families are still in Iran and they are now all alone in Afghanistan. Zia Sharia from the BBC Persian service told me more.
The Taliban border officials in the Nimruz province in western Afghanistan have local media in Afghanistan saying that they have registered 20,000 unaccompanied children, mostly under 15 years old, in the last year who have been deported from Iran. And these children are in a very difficult situation. One of the officials has said that they have been able to manage finding the parents or the family members of 3,000 of these kids, but the rest of them are still in an uncertain situation. A lot of them have their families back in Iran because they've been, according to reports, deported when they were working on the street or when they were away from their parents. Many of them are children and their parents who have not got documents in Iran. Millions of Afghans live in Iran and a lot of them haven't got refugee status or official documents. So many of them are arrested and just directly taken to camps and then deported. Obviously, their families are looking for them, but also the other problem is that probably many of these families who are living in Iran, they're living in hiding, working in hiding. They don't have movement capacity easily and they could be arrested anytime and just deported back.
So we're talking about something like 17,000 of the children who have no contact with their parents. Who's looking after them in Afghanistan?
The Taliban have said that's them who are looking after them, but also some NGOs and UN agencies who are helping with them. We do know a lot about deportations of the adults from Iran. Hundreds of thousands have been deported in the last few months. But with regards to these children, we're looking for more details, obviously.
And is this something that's got a lot worse since the Taliban came back into power in Afghanistan? Because we're also seeing Afghans being deported from Pakistan.
That's right. Yeah. Since the Taliban took over in August 2021, millions have fled the country, majority of them to neighboring countries, Pakistan and Iran. The Iranian officials have announced there are 5 million Afghans in Iran. At least 1 to 2 million have fled in the last 2-3 years. And the same problem in Pakistan.
Dear Sharia of the BBC Persian Service. Now, it may not be as celebrated as music and film, but the gaming industry is huge. It was thought to be worth more than $200 billion globally in 2023. On Thursday night here in London, it was celebrated in the BAFTA Games Awards. Our reporter Guy Lambert was there.
Hello, BAFTA Games Awards 2024!
With 10 nominations, all eyes are on the team behind Baldur's Gate 3, the third instalment in a series based on the popular fantasy role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons. And they weren't disappointed, picking up 5 awards, including Best Narrative, the Player's Choice Award, which was decided by a public vote, and the top prize of Best Game. Best British Game went to Viewfinder, where players have to use Polaroid photographs to solve puzzles and advance through different levels. The gaming industry was worth nearly $6 billion to the UK economy in 2023, and the ceremony showed just how valuable and diverse the games on offer are right now.
Guy Lambert. To mark the state visit to the US by the Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, President Biden has announced that a Japanese astronaut will become the first non-American to set foot on the moon during one of NASA's upcoming Artemis missions. The program aims to put people back on the lunar surface for the first time in more than 50 years, ahead of potential missions to Mars. Naoko Yamazaki is one of only 2 Japanese women to ever go into space. She's been talking to James Menendez.
I was so excited about the agreement because, you know, to sending a Japanese astronaut to the moon, it's such a huge goal.
What does it mean for Japan and particularly for its space program?
Japan has been participating in the International Space Station program since mid-80s. We are very proud of being a part of such an Artemis international program. Human presence on the moon means a lot. Because there are, you know, so many problems on the ground, but if we can expand our frontier, we can expand our possibilities to solve the problems from space.
Do you think that's true? I mean, you went up to the International Space Station. Do you think international collaboration in space is good for diplomacy?
Yes, I think so. 15 nations are involved in the International Space Station. And now 36 nations have signed the agreement of the Artemis program. I think it is a good thing to expand our collaboration in space because it is important to utilize space in an ordered way.
And why do we need to go back to the moon? Because, of course, we have been there before.
In the past years, we found water on the moon, which is in an ice shape or within the rocks. So if we can utilize the water on the moon, then it makes us easier to fly to Mars.
I mean, it was dangerous back in the 1960s. Is it still dangerous? Will it be dangerous now to undertake that mission to the moon?
I think so. Human space program, of course, involves risks in it. And there is no mission with zero risks. But we should pay the risks to expand our frontier.
And the Japanese astronaut who will walk on the moon one day, I mean, would you like that to be a woman? I mean, are there women astronauts coming through now who would be eligible?
Of course. And last year, Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency selected 2 new astronaut candidates, 1 man and 1 woman. So I'm looking forward to seeing both on the moon.
Will you be feeling a bit jealous when it happens?
To tell you the truth, yes. I wish I could be there, of course.
Is it amazing going into space? Do you miss those days?
Yes, I miss the feeling of microgravity and I miss the international collaboration in space.
Retired Japanese astronaut Naoko Yamazaki talking to James Menendez. Finally, 3 men stranded on an uninhabited desert island have been rescued by the US Coast Guard. Stephanie Zacherson takes up the story.
It was a journey that started on a 7-metre open skiff when the sailors, all in their 40s, set off on their adventure in the Pacific Ocean. They'd left the coral atoll Poliwhat in Micronesia on the last day of March. But 6 days later, the emergency services received a distress call. It was from a woman reporting that her three uncles hadn't returned home as expected. A rescue operation was organised, but the mission seemed as challenging as finding a needle in a haystack. The Federated States of Micronesia, south of Guam and north of Papua New Guinea, consists of no less than 607 islands. The initial search area was nearly 270,000 square kilometres, and the weather conditions were poor. But the crew of a reconnaissance aircraft spotted a makeshift sign. On the beach of a tiny island, they could read the word HELP, spelled out with large leaves from palm trees covering the white sand. It was a crucial factor in the discovery of the men, allowing the plane to airdrop survival packages and a radio to the stranded trio. They radioed back, saying they were in good health, but needed some help getting back home. The next day, the castaways were picked up by the Coast Guard. The men had survived on coconut meat and water from a small well on the island. It is the second time in 4 years that people have been rescued from Pikelet Atoll. After the rescue, the Coast Guard gave a word of advice to anyone setting sail, saying that they should always take an emergency locator beacon with them.
Stephanie Zacherson. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes-Porter and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.